Okay, so we got a few viewers. We got 9 viewers so far in the chat. Hello, everyone. How are you guys doing? This is going to be in English this time. I'll present. Well, this is Victor Peralta. He will introduce himself in a while, but this will be the first live stream on Nostr for me. Interview, Nostr exclusive. It won't go on YouTube unless he decides it's okay, because we're going to be speaking about a few spicy topics, and he's in academia, so yeah, he's got to be a bit careful. It's very left leaning here in Mexico as well, academia. So, anyways, enough talk. Victor, please, can you introduce yourself? Like, who are you? What do you do for a living? And
sure. I'm a northern born Mexican. And that says something to most Mexicans, because it's very meaningful, the region you're born in. And I was raised in center Mexico in a state called Zacatecas. It's very religious region. It's a very Catholic region. It has changed in the past decades, as everything in the culture has changed in the world. And I studied philosophy and law there. When I finished law school, that is around 5 years, philosophy school, bachelor school is 4 years. So I finished philosophy. Then I had to be at law school one more year. I was accepted in the master's program in philosophy. The specialty was philosophy of logic, philosophy of language, and philosophy of mind at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, better known as UNAM. And I was there from 2005 to 2007. From there on, I have been working in academia, mostly in the field of logic, even though I have given a lot of courses. I have been the professor in a lot of other subjects, but mostly critical thinking and those kinds of topics. I have always lived in Mexico, and so that serves to explain why I will be struggling with the English somehow. So I ask you guys for some patience. And maybe I should say that in philosophy school and the bachelor degree at the undergraduate level, we need to do two sorts of basic works to be able to graduate. And sort of in Mexico, we call them tesinas, which is like an article, like a paper, two papers with minimum rigor. And I did one in a field that nowadays would be considered sort of philosophy of artificial intelligence and epistemology. Gödelian arguments, if you know the term. I delved deep into the Hofstadter's book, Gödel, Lecher, and Bach, An Internal Golden Braid. I love that book. It's a Pulitzer Prize awarded book. And the other topic that I specialized in at that moment was anarchism, modern theories of anarchism.
Awesome.
So, yeah, I basically...
You told me, I think you told me some time ago, you were initially a socialist, I believe, correct? Like your way of thinking was socialist.
Yeah.
So how did that transition happen exactly? Like you were exposed to anarchy once you took that, you started studying in this course?
Yeah. Well, I also was a skateboarder. So we kind of always have this emotional tendency to chaos and to enjoy smashing authority and that stuff. Those kinds of things. I listened to Pennywise and NoFX and those bands. And I was a socialist my immediate family, my mother especially, was very, very left-leaning. So the way that I conciliated these two things was to focus on the authoritarian aspects of capitalism, or what seemed to be authoritarian aspects of capitalism. So I started there, but my goal was always to aim for a society with no coercion, where coercion was not necessary. So if I wasn't able to alienate anarchism with socialism, I would have dropped socialism way before.
Okay.
So there is this tendency among specialists in Marxist, let's say, positions and Marxian theories and stuff, to say that the end goal of all his political struggles is anarchism as well. So it's, they also seem to know that they are playing with fire, you know, with authoritarianism. Even for a period of time, when they conquer power and they get very, very nasty, very, very violent and very controlling and stuff, they tend to say that it is just a phase that is justified, because after that phase, we will reach total liberty and total...
Basically, what happened in the USSR, no? Actually, back then, socialism and communism were synonyms, I believe, and...
In the United States, because yeah, in Mexico, and the left-leaning people, they always have, how do you say, when they cringe at that idea. They if you, as a leftist, would start hearing somebody saying that socialism and communism are the same thing, the supposedly experts on left theories and Marxism and stuff would cringe at your comment.
I was referring back to, like, historically, like I'm talking about 1800s, socialism and communism were synonyms. And then I believe it was Stalin who came up with that new concept that, no, right now we are living in socialism and we got to get through some tough shit and then we will reach communism, which is the utopia. So I believe that's where it started to get supposedly differentiated. But no, it was obviously used as synonyms.
Yeah,
interchangeably back then, I believe. Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong.
There are differences, you know. I mean, at least in Latin America, from the times that I was being politically awakened, when I was a young person, like maybe 12, 13, 14 years old, it's always been like that. And let me remember, because I think that those separations are even... can be grounded on Marxist writings and they're very, very, very close concepts. So,
have you read any of Marx's texts?
Yeah,
Das Kapital and all that.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. Very few people, I think, because it's like a huge, huge book. No, multiple volumes. Das Kapital.
Yeah, I did it a lot of time ago, and it is a very heavy reading. And very recently I read some things in that book because I needed to write a chapter in a book. I ended up not needing that information, those quotations, but yeah, I'm no expert on that. I don't want to lose much time.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense, to be honest. But I do have a question right now. Is there a different type of socialism here in Latin America as compared to other parts of the world? Like, is there a special flavor to socialism in here in LATAM? Or is it similar to any other types of socialism? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because you can have an approach, like a very, let's say, scientific approach to designing socialist institutions. You would get some sort of social momentum inspired by those ideas, very like what you have in the United States. Well, not you personally, but what people have in the States through the Democratic Party. I don't know if that's the same kind of aim, project, specifics of the left-leaning forces in Latin America. So let me say this. This is a sociological point. Left-leaning people in Latin America are very, very close to causes like the Free Palestine movement, the Iran thesis that the United States is Satan and needs to be destroyed. But also in Iberoamerica, they tend to be very anti-clerical, like very, very angry against the church, especially Catholic Church, and many other, very tense ideas and actions and inertia.
Intense. Okay. Yeah.
Tense, like contradictory. So they're very tense. Why are they very anti-religious in Mexico, but they are supporting the theological regime of Iran? Why? It's very close to being consistent. And they tend to have a very strong distrust in anything American, anything from the United States. So they are, I don't know, it's, you can be a socialist of a flavor, let's say American flavor, and you can be a socialist of another flavor, let's say the Islamic flavor, and you can be a socialist of another flavor, like Latin American flavor. I'm worried because I think that the Latin American strain of socialism has invaded the United States.
Oh, really? You think it hasn't been the other way around? Like...
I don't know. You never know at the end. Authorities are very sneaky. Intelligence agencies are very sneaky. But the I don't know if this datum is precise, but I think Black Lives Matter was very heavily financed by the Hugo Chavez regime, the Maduro regime. I don't know how many millions they were able to allocate with Black Lives Matter, and what did that action accomplish? Also, this guy, James Lindsay, do you know this?
Yeah, I know.
From the grievance studies, James Lindsay has documented that many of the leftist ideas now very potent in the United States, especially in academia, have come from Latin America, from some clerical, some priests, Catholic priests, the theology of liberation. He has extensive work on that. And so I really don't know if we contaminated the states or the states have manipulated these political forces to achieve something. I don't know. But, that's interesting. That's an interesting sociological hypothesis. I don't know.
It is. It'd be very interesting. I didn't ever hear that theory. No, that Hugo Chavez might have... gave some money to Orsa, supported BLM, Black Lives Matter. I have to look into that, but that sounds interesting, actually. So yeah. It's like a big melting pot, I guess, you know, between the different sociological ideologies. So within socialism, I guess you could say there are a lot of subtypes. So it's very interesting how it varies, obviously, culture by culture, how it manifests. And in Mexico, for example, do you see the most of the population? Would you say they are socialists willingly or like unknowingly? Because I understand that most people are fairly ignorant, so they'll just go with what the government tells them. Because it sounds very good to when the government says, "Let's give more money to the poor, let's tax the rich." So, like a lot of times, people are socialists without really knowing that they're like socialist and thing, because these things sound fair, that sounds nice, but what's your opinion on that?
Well,
for the average Mexican,
my experience in Mexico, being a professor mostly for freshman year college students, is the following. People tend to be sloppy when it comes to political thinking. So they have the aim when they act as a citizen and when they think about society and the state and stuff, they tend to think that the most legitimate goal is the socialist goal.
Yeah.
So they think anything that is public, anything that is going to be coerced publicly, any law, any sort of institution or whatever, has to benefit at least the majority. And if it's going to benefit a portion of the society, it has to benefit those that are the weakest. But we should try to benefit all society. So in that regard, I think they have a very close commitment with socialism. And they tend to think that makes them socialists. But if you enforce real socialism as it had been tried everywhere in the world.
Well, that wasn't real socialism, yeah.
Well, you know that discussion. Mexicans will revolt, like in a fraction of a second. The Mexicans are very, very talented to how do you say in English to
point to out what? Or criticize or
no to escape obligations to
yeah okay.
To twitch the ideas and stuff.
To tweak them around. Okay. So like,
yeah.
So for example, I know my parents, for example, they know that Cuban socialism and the Venezuelan socialism / communism is bad like that. And that to them, that is that's actual communism. And they see Mexico and they don't see the same. Well, to them, AMLO, you know, this the current president. I know, yeah. I think it's already changed, right? Sheinbaum is already in power.
Recently former president, yeah.
Recently, yeah, former president. So like they see him as clearly left guy. But I take anyone before him as not left leaning. But if you think about it, in Mexico it's kinda all type of government is honestly socialist. There's a lot of government intervention in the economy. That's socialism basically, you know. So they can't see these type of things. They see the world as black, you know, black and white. So like these are the communists, these are the capitalists, more or less. So I think in Mexico, another question, what do you think led to the rise of AMLO, López Obrador? And why do you think we had one of the most bloodiest elections in a long time?
Yeah, well, I was a pejista and an AMLO follower at the beginning of the century.
Oh, interesting.
I even voted for him in 2006, and I went to Mexico City to before 2006 to La Marcha of, I don't remember the name right now. I'm even a little bit ashamed to say it, but I need to come clean because I talk from my experience. And those years thought a lot of far-fetched things. Like, for instance, we thought that the NAFTA agreement was, at the end, very, very damaging to Mexico. We thought that it was an agreement that was being opening the doors to exploit Mexico. We thought at those years that Mexico, if it would have closed its borders, we would be far from there. And we could even help our brothers in Latin America. So we I even came to the extent to think that if we placed our army in the northern border to avoid Mexicans going to the States,
wow,
we could be better because they were benefiting from cheap labor and natural resources and exploitation and corruption in Mexico. So, well, and I think that I was very, very moved by desperation and my emotions risen from being able to see poverty. So when you see poverty, you think, what can I do? And I alone cannot do anything, cannot do much. So somebody has to do something.
And you think, what can I do right now, right?
Yeah. Right now, yeah.
There's
no
long-term thinking, usually, when these emotional
thoughts happen. Yeah, so you're desperate because you see a child that is hungry, and or a family that has a father who is sick and who is in desperate need of resources. So that emotion is very powerful, and when you have that emotion, you say, "Well, I need, let's say, $100,000 to perform this operation on this person. And where is that money? In the bank or in the bank accounts of rich people? And I would try to reach it. And what or who would try to stop me? And those are the police, the greedy capitalists, the capitalist institutions protecting private property and stuff." So that's how, through that emotion, you see the world, you know?
Yeah.
And because you say, it's very easy. I would go to the bank with a chart or with a note. I have this person, Juan Perez, who is going through cancer, needs $100,000 for his operation. So give it to me. I will take it, the money to this person. And the bank would say no, because reasons, you know? So if you paint the way you see reality through this emotion, that's a very clear venue for looking for someone who tells you. The differences between money inequalities, they say, economic inequalities, should be destroyed. They don't say how, but you relate to that feeling, you know? And I think that feeling is rampant nowadays.
Yeah. For those just joining in on the live stream, Victor Peralta was basically describing more or less what the socialist mentality is, at least here in Mexico, and what was going on through his mind back then when he was a socialist. So yeah, basically that was going on through your mind, and basically learning about anarchy is what made you. Basically, I think you described very well. It's coercion. Yeah. What makes socialism work? That's what it is. You have to force other people to do things that you want or you consider to be okay, and it's a mob rule. That's how you get these things done. On the contrary, like anarcho-capitalism is basically the individual has the biggest say, you know, and it's the better way to organize society and raise capital. Well, appropriate allocation of capital it's done at an individual level. Only you know what you need, what you want to buy, and that gives the market signals as well. So, well, I don't want to get too deep into this. I'm no expert in economics. I do study a lot. I don't know if you know who Saifedean Ammous is. I've been reading his books. I'm in his course, so I've been learning about Austrian economics for like a few years now. But anyways, what I want to get to, I don't want to get bogged down too much in this topic, because on Auster, a lot of people are anarchists or minarchists, at least, or basically they want
less coercion
or agree with minimal government intervention. Yep. So. There's I don't know if you know who Walk. I guess you don't know who he is. It's called The Bitcoin Podcast. The man is called Walker. His last name is Walker. I'm guessing you know who Ludwig von Mises is, right?
Yeah. So I have read some things of von Mises.
Of him, So Walker has been doing some readings from this conference that Ludwig gave in Argentina back in the 50s, I believe. So it's a series of lectures, and the most recent lecture was foreign investment and how that's important for developing countries to receive capital, because when you have capital, you can advance as a society. So that was a very interesting, because also back then when I was a socialist without really knowing it, it made sense I also thought somewhat similar, like Mexico should just like close its borders. And, you know, we have plenty of young people. We can make Mexico rich and prosperous. But, you know, there's one giant thing that's missing. That's capital. So the best way to receive capital in a relatively faster way is through foreign investment. People who already have capital. For example, labor is cheaper in Mexico than the United States. So that attracts capital over here. And anyways, it's fascinating what you get taught in school or what society teaches you, which is the proper economics or proper way of leading a country. And then all this stuff buried underneath the ground. I didn't know what Austrian economics was until after med school and reading about things myself. But anyways, going on to the next topic, because I really want to get into trying to orange pill or purple pill you. But before that, I want to get into the carnivore story. So you're also a carnivore, right? Yeah. So if you could tell us a bit about that, what brought you into the carnivore diet?
Well, we already made an interview with more details there, but there were a few important things. One was that I was starting to have joint pain. And I had some family members sick. My mother-in-law, who passed away like 1 year ago from glioblastoma. Suddenly I forgot the term in English. Brain cancer.
Oh, that's it.
And I was launched to read a lot and try to make sense of many things that from my perspective did not make very much sense. So I came to know Dr. Ken Berry, Anthony Chafee. First it was just Ken Berry, and he explained like what is gout and stuff. He has short videos, very, very easy to follow. And I came to the best of my understanding to two possibilities. Either my joint pain in the hands, because I had joint pain in the lower back, in the knees, and the tobillos, how do you say it? The ankles.
Yeah.
The ankles. Because of my years skateboarding and playing basketball. So doctors told you, always tell you that lesions with those two sports are very hard to overcome with the years. So they even advise you to stop, do not practice those sports. If you have any sort of proclivity to develop or to have an injury. So I thought those were normal, and I started to feel joint pain in the hands, and that worried me a lot. So that was launched me to try something. So I had a two-way street. Just either red meat was causing me gout, or the start of something like that, gout or something similar. Or the other thing was something in the vegetables that I had been eating for years, all my life really. Already started to cripple me more thoroughly, more completely. And because I love the taste of meat, I started with the carnivore hypothesis first. And it turned out like a miracle. I did not just recover from the joint pain. I gained strength in the hands as well. My joint pain in the lower back and the knees and the ankles just went away. I was able to skateboard again many months later. And, well, a lot of benefits, a lot. There is a big list. So I remember that I saw the talk, the supposedly censored talk of Michaela Peterson, telling her story, and I thought, poor thing, this lady is allergic to everything. But I am one of the lucky ones. I can digest vegetables. So a lot of time from that point passed since I tried the carnivore diet, because I thought I was one of the fortunate guys that could handle metabolical.
Yeah, be like an omnivore, supposedly.
Yeah. I tend to have a lot of respect for doctors, but also as a critical thinking professor, I can recognize when I'm bullshitting myself, when I'm telling me to myself reasons that are not very sound. Because you have the training, you have, when I put it in paper, let's say, my argument would have not looked very good. So I had to put into a box the medical institution's recommendations also. So that was a little bit scary, but not too scary. And before all this, I had I was close to a nutritionist who was a doctor here in Cancun, Marcos and Sendeñas maybe. And he's very enthusiastic of the keto diets. So I was in ketosis before when I was working with him for some 1 or 2 years. He promised me, because I thought that nutritional sciences was mostly garbage, I never trusted a nutritionist major. Yeah. But this was a medical doctor specialized in nutrition, and he promised me, you will have energy to swim and go to the work and everything. And I said, okay. It's sort of like a bet. I take it. I said, if it does not, you will give me back my money, sort of thing. And it worked well. So I had that antecedent, and that the medical community was not too opposed to the carnivore diet. So that helped me.
Well, I mean, perhaps in Mexico. I think, well, from what I've seen and heard in the United States, like, it's still very, very much opposed. Doctors losing even their licenses. Here in Mexico, I've heard from a few patients that there are some doctors working locally who propose eating more meat. Being full carnivore, no, because they still think that that's perhaps too extreme. But I don't see, in Mexico, at least from what I'm seeing, there doesn't seem to be any pushback on doctors who promote this diet. I personally haven't received any pushback from the authorities. So maybe it's a bit more free here. But I also think that since it's not very well known in Mexico and Latin America, I think in general, I think that that's also why there hasn't been any pushback as well. So it could be those two things. Either, we're more free to do what we want, or it just hasn't popped up in the radar, the authorities' radar yet. So we'll see. I don't know where this will lead in the future, but hopefully it stays. They leave us alone. Like, those doctors who want to promote the carnivore diet can hopefully do so without much problem. Because I know Dr. Sean Baker. Sorry?
As long as you pay your taxes, they will leave you alone.
I hope so. Yeah. Mexico is kind of like the Wild West in that regard. There's ways to get around issues and certain things. But sorry, before I interrupted you. Also, real quick question. Your family member who died of glioblastoma, she was a vegetarian her whole life or something like that, right?
But she was also an anthropologist, so she made exceptions. When she went to study a community, for instance, and if this community was, like, let's say, poor, and they would receive her, if this community offered meat, she would take it. But okay. It was very exceptional. At the last years of her life, maybe she would eat some fish, but the rest of her life, when she was a vegetarian, she would only have cheese, eggs, and the rest was, you know, curcuma and spinach and every kind of plant.
If it's possible to know, like, what age was she when she passed away?
She was around 73, maybe.
73. Okay, yeah. The average Mexican life expectancy for a woman is around 74, 76, I believe. So, yeah, she actually reached the average life expectancy, which is, like, she didn't, that's the average in a metabolically ill person. Like, there's reasons to believe, like, in research, that humans, you know, if they follow proper human diet, they're active, they get sunlight. Like, if they just get out of their way, like, make sure they don't do things that screw up your health. In theory, the human lifespan can be up to 120, 150 years even. So if you take into consideration some passing away around their 70s, basically they died at half the, their expected lifespan. I don't know if that's true. No one can, there's no way to actually prove that, just a theory, but that'd be pretty amazing. Now, obviously what matters even more than reaching that age is how you reach that age, the quality of life. I think that's even more important, which I think is achievable if you do things like a low carb diet, you ground, you get some sunbathing. If your mitochondrial haplotype allows it, do cold thermogenesis as well. You know, it's a lot of different things you can do to boost your health and increase quality of life. So sorry before I interrupted you here.
Don't worry. And a comment that might strike people more is, if now we're planning to live like 70 to the age of 70, 75. Imagine that all people started dying at 35, like half that. So if our real number is 120, let's say, for sake of your information, of your argument, then people are dying half the way to what they could live in with a high quality of life. So those that already made their minds living up to 74, let's say, and any extra year would be like a gift,
a victory,
a victory, whatever. Imagine that people started dying at 35, which is like half point at that 38, 39, and that's happening. Yeah, I'm sure you're seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it is actually a lot of obesity in Mexico, for example. There's like 75% of the population. This includes both children, adults. Around 75 is either overweight or obese. So that's incredible. Like, wow. And it's true. You go to the supermarket and you just look around. You go to downtown, you look around, and you can clearly see these overweight, obese people.
Yeah.
And it's really sad to see, especially the children.
Yeah.
The children are really, really, really sick, metabolically unwell.
My students are from the ages 17 to 20, let's say, most of my students. And they are in a very sorry condition. Cancers or threats of cancer, like, you know, little bumps in their bodies, and they have to rush to take a sample or
So they have like little tumors around showing up in different parts of their body.
Yeah, to discard those. Yeah. And a next student of mine, she's like 30 years maybe. She's a swimmer and stuff. Just recently graduated from undergraduate school. And she started giving as a lecturer in my university too. And she had to miss work for 15 days because she needed to have a biopsy of a lump inside her spine.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if I don't know the procedures, but it was something to test if the
biopsy. If it's a malignant or, well, to identify the characteristics of this apparent tumor or lesion. It's tragic because a lot of times plants, it's not just the sugar or the fructose that's damaging us. It's also the toxins within the plants, like oxalates. You got things like lectins, but more specifically, oxalates. That's more abundant in people who eat a lot of spinach. I don't know how you. I forgot the name for acelgas and beetroots, and I forgot the names in English.
Leaves and chocolate, and
and also nuts, things like cacahuates, which are normal nuts, almonds, like these are rich in oxalates, and it's just a family of toxins. So like there's like oxalic salts, oxalic acid, etc. So the oxalic acid is what goes into your bloodstream, and that can accumulate in your tissues, any tissue basically, and that's why it presents itself. It varies a lot from person to person because it can be in any type of tissue in your body. So this leads to chronic inflammation and can lead to, chronic inflammation. And then if on top of that, you're a diabetic, which if you're a diabetic, you are in a chronic inflammatory state. So you combine all these different factors, and that has been seen to promote cancer basically cancer has been, I'm sure you've heard of Thomas Seyfried. It seems that cancer more and more is being proven to be more of a metabolic disease than merely a genetic one. I'm sure there can be some genetic predisposition to developing cancer, but what pulls the trigger is most likely poor metabolic health. And so from what I understood, that's exactly why you started looking into the carnivore diet, right? Because of cancer in your family?
In my family, my political family. Because also my father-in-law died like 10 or 12 years ago from cancer also. He was also a yogi. He was an anthropologist. He was very healthy in the paper, in the sense that they would not drink too much alcohol. My mother-in-law, zero alcohol. Just fruits, vegetables, and exercise, meditation, taking care of the spirit, you know. They have a very interesting library at their homes. I was able to be 2 or 3 days going through all the readings they've made. And they're very interesting, very well-formed persons back then, students, college students, and professionals as well, because they were researchers at the INAH, Instituto Nacional de Antropología e Historia, National Institute of Anthropology and History here in Mexico. They are responsible for taking care of the ruins when people come to Mexico.
So they were outside a lot, and
they had
basically healthy lifestyle in every possible way.
Yeah, so that shocked me. That was a very shocking fact. So I was really needing to make sense of that, and that was a very powerful motive to delve into this. And also, my anarchist tendencies made me very suspicious of any authority, epistemic or political or whatever. I tend to be very
skeptical. You know, I think you have the attributes and the potential to become a Bitcoiner and an Oster user. I told you before, Dr. Ken Berry is finally on Oster. He is also a Bitcoiner. I believe that Dr. Anthony Chafee might also be a Bitcoiner. Really? And it all leads down to, like, the way I see it is, when you realize one supposed truth in your life was a lie, such as nutrition, for example, and you realize it's a lie, you start to question yourself, what else have I been lied about? You know, you start looking at economics, you start looking to different types of fields, and usually money is one of them. And that's what leads you down to Bitcoin. Like, sometimes you wonder, like, why, no matter how hard I work, my wife also works, like, we just never have enough money. We have a degree, you know, we studied, we did everything right. They told us that if we study hard enough, get a good job, that we should be able to have a house. And then you look to your past, you can see maybe your parents, your grandparents, they didn't have to work as hard to own a little house, a little plot of land, have food every day on the table. And maybe the wife didn't have to work at all. She was at home taking care of the children. Just one person had to work. And now it's everyone has to work. And then 2 or 3 jobs just to get by, especially in Mexico. So those questions start to get into you. So I'm saying all this. Why? Because I think it's time to do some number crunching. A very common thing amongst Bitcoiners is something we say a lot is number go up technology. So that's what Bitcoin is. It's what attracts people initially. Let's be honest. A lot of reasons for people getting into Bitcoin initially is money, because they see, oh, it's going up. So I want a piece of that. So that's why I want to focus on that, because apparently that's the statistics. Later on, once you start to study Bitcoin and understand it better, you start seeing it more from a more humanistic or ethical perspective, what Bitcoin means, because it means a lot to different types of people. And there's different ways to see how it helps solve a lot of problems in the world. And there's a lot of people in the Bitcoin space who help do that, like Alex Gladstein. I believe it's Alex Gladstein. Correct me if I'm wrong, people in the audience. But he looks into how the IMF is a plague and destruction. The International Monetary Fund, they gave money to developing countries, for example, people who need money. And he goes into detail of how that's actually destroying these economies in these countries. And it's amazing what Bitcoin can help fix. It's not just making you richer over time. So I'm going to quickly share my screen. This here is a Excel sheet. I don't think you know who Michael Saylor is, but basically he's one of the, he's like the first guy to, not the first guy perhaps, but he's gone all in on Bitcoin. He has a public company in the United States called MicroStrategy. And they've been putting their treasuries, I mean, well, not treasuries, sorry, all their cash flow, extra cash flow into Bitcoin. You know, instead of holding gold, buying back stocks and, you know, all these other type of things people do to increase the value of a company, they decide to put all their money into Bitcoin. Why? Because it's not a melting ice cube. Because if you hold it, no billionaire holds cash. Like no billionaire has millions of dollars in his bank account in the form of cash. Why? Because it's a melting ice cube. It's inflation is eating it up. They have assets. That's what the rich people have. So basically, he looked into every single asset back then, I think around COVID or 2019, I forgot exactly when. And he came out with the conclusion that Bitcoin is simply the best thing to have. So real quick, just so you can see more or less the power. Can you see the screen?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I just want to look at the bottom of the graphic to see what are the axes in years.
Yeah, we'll explain it later. But basically, this is the year. Let me explain it real quick. So Michael Saylor recently, this is open source. This is available in GitHub. You can download this Excel sheet and you can play around with your own models and whatnot. So he has three cases for Bitcoin: a bear case, a base case, and a bull case. In case you don't know, bear case is like the worst case scenario, bull case is best case scenario, and base case is what, you know, the average or the more or less expected, most probable thing to occur. So he takes into consideration, this is for Bitcoin's growth in the future from here to 2045. Yeah, so that's 20 years from now, more or less. So he takes into account, like in the case of the base case, the average return rate of Bitcoin, he calculates it'll be 50% year over year, reducing 2.5% every single year, you know, because Bitcoin's average return year over year has been around, I think, 60% more or less. So that's huge. Like, yeah. People like Warren Buffett can't do that. Like, I think their best year is like 20. I mean, I think it's around 20% year over year. But anyways, to make things short, he calculates in the bear case by 2045, one Bitcoin will be worth $3.2 million. Base case, one Bitcoin will be worth $13.4 million. And in the bull case, it'll be worth $49.2 million. So that's amazing. So, okay, fantastic. We'll take a base case for now. Now let's go to the individual. This is another, you wanted to see real quick the graph below, right? So it simply is the time and the value of Bitcoin. Yeah, right. Is it
that Bitcoin will be worth that much, or our fiat money will be worth that much less, let's say?
Astute observation. Yes, exactly. So like the dollar has no bottom because people can just print it out to infinity. You can do the same thing here for real estate and whatnot, and the value of real estate will also go up. It's that. I don't think here he took into consideration the inflation of the dollar per se, but because here I think he explained it once in a video, it's how, because there's a lot of money in other assets right now, like real estate, bonds, and equities. Cool. And a lot of people will realize that these are not good enough and that Bitcoin is simply the better asset. So money from these other assets will start to flow into Bitcoin. And he is taking into consideration also Bitcoin's average growth year over year. I don't think, and someone correct me if I'm wrong in the comments, he's not factoring in the inflation of the dollar. So if you take in the inflation of the dollar, I actually think this will be worth more, you know, adjusted to for inflation. Yeah. So instead of being 13.4 million by 2045, it could be worth twice that, or who knows, but that's just my assumption. So anyways, for the individual, let's say you're right now, you decide to simply buy 0.1 Bitcoin. Yeah. That's a tenth of a whole Bitcoin. And let's say you have some money saved up in the bank. Let's say it's $1,000. Yeah. And how much does the average Mexican earn in more or less. Let's say for the average professional, how much does he earn? Like 20,000 pesos a month, 30,000 pesos?
30. In my field, well, yeah, it's very tricky because universities have very disparaging.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, maybe 18,000, 20,000.
Let's be a bit more optimistic. Let's say you can side hustle. Let's say it's 30,000 for whatever reason. Let's say like you combine the salary from your wife, you know? So let's say combine, it's like, because I already made the calculation before.
Yeah.
So it's 19,000. This is in thousands. So that's like $19,000 a year earnings, which is around 30,000 pesos a month. I already did the math there. It's more or less. And let's say your earnings increase by 5%, right, year over year. How much taxes do you pay in that bracket? Like, I think it's like, like 20%.
Yeah, maybe. No, well, it has been calculated that including IVA and the rights and stuff, maybe it's like 40-45% if you're in the formal sector. Yeah. If you're in the informal sector, maybe you can drop that.
Oh, okay. So we'll leave it at 40 then. Okay. Yeah. So you have you decide to buy 0.1 Bitcoin right now. Let's say you have an extra $1,000 lying around there in your savings account or whatnot. You earn $19,000 a year. And we're expecting that to grow at just 5%, maybe to supposedly keep up with inflation, which it's not. And this is the income tax. So now we have to classify what you are. So are you a normie, a Bitcoin maxi, a double maxi, a triple maxi? To describe this, a normie is a person who just buys Bitcoin and I think puts some of what he earns into at least like 25% more or less. For you to understand what a double maxi is, which is what a lot of Bitcoiners are, they put everything they own into Bitcoin. Like they have no other assets other than Bitcoin. And a triple maxi is a person who also takes on leverage, which is what Michael Saylor does. Not recommended for much people. So for many people. So let's see. Oh, here's a mortgage though. Mortgage. Let's see. Let's take away mortgage costs. Let's make it more simple.
Yeah, because for some kinds of credits you can stop paying taxes, no? So it might be convenient in some states.
Yeah. So, anyways, let's look at the stats. I could be doing this wrong, right? I did something wrong. That's a triple maxi. Sorry, I selected triple maxi. Bum bum bum. Strategy will be that. Let's go double maxi. So it's someone who puts all of their wealth into Bitcoin. I still think something was strange. I'm doing something wrong here. Ah, here it is. For some reason, it's taking into consideration one Bitcoin, but why? Net assets. I don't know why it's doing that. Hold on, let me see. There we go. Okay, I have no idea why that. Oh, that was never mind. That was $100,000. Okay, so let's say one. That equals, that should be $1,000 and something else. There we go. Now it's corrected. So supposing you just buy one Bitcoin right now and you only have $1,000 in like a savings account, you put that in, you convert into Bitcoin as well, blah, blah, blah. This is more or less taking into consideration the base case. You would have $1 million by the time it's 2035. Also, take into consideration that you take from your earnings, you're saving 25% of it, you know, to put into Bitcoin.
And yeah. $1 million at current value, or
Like value as of in theory right now, right? Like it might $1 million in the future might not be able to buy you as much, but if you take into consideration inflation. I really don't think it'll be $1 million. It'll be worth even more because of that. No, because inflation. Yeah. But yeah, that's like current, let's say $1 million. I don't know if I'm explaining that correct. Yeah, it's $1 million as of right now, you know? Not adjusted for inflation, I believe that's a term. So yeah, by 2035, which is 10 years from now, you would in theory have... With 0.3 Bitcoin, as you can see, it becomes harder and harder to accumulate Bitcoin over time because the price begins to increase. So you have 0.1 here. You start accumulating. You manage to reach 0.3 and it stays there. supposing that your salary stays at $19,000 a year with just an average growth rate of 5% year over year, take into consideration your income tax and whatnot. So you can become a millionaire by 10 years from now. By 2045, that amount, your Bitcoin will be worth $4 million. So this is the power of compound interest, you know? So it's just, you hold on to your Bitcoin, you don't sell it, or you don't sell much of it, you know, you just hold on to as much of it as you can. And that's just going to compound over time. So I'm no financial expert or analytical expert. So there's like a lot of things I could be missing here. But this is just the gist of it. That's how I basically understood it. I can pass you this Excel sheet yourself so you can play around with it. Now, just so you can see the difference, this is a double maxi. A normie is just a person who just keeps his $1,000 and has, I guess, a savings rate of 2,000. Hold on, just buys this. Is a person who just buys 0.1 Bitcoin and then doesn't do anything, doesn't put any more Bitcoin into it. So you can see this person doesn't buy any more Bitcoin, decides to do absolutely nothing, just buys 0.1 right now. With time, you would have $1 million by 2038. It's not that much of a difference, you think about it, right? Because the previous example was 2035 when you had $1 million. And here, by 2045, it's worth already $2 million. That's just buying 0.1 Bitcoin right now. So and not putting any more money into Bitcoin.
How much is a Bitcoin right now? Like $600,000?
No. Right now it's around like $62,000, I believe, $61,000. But you can buy like 100 pesos of Bitcoin if you want, depending on the exchange. You don't have to buy. One Bitcoin can be subdivided into 100 million Satoshis.
You know, I went into cryptos just to attempt some trading. Because I want to learn that, not especially because I had much faith in it. Yeah. I used to watch a lot of Steven Crowder. Do you know the Louder with Crowder podcast?
I've heard of Steven Crowder. Not really. Don't know exactly. I don't remember what he does, though, what he talks about.
He's a comedian. It's actually very funny. But he tends to make a lot of sense. And he and his team have very great insights. I haven't watch him in a while, but I learn a lot. And they are always mocking of cryptocurrency, saying that it is a haven,
a haven
for illegal activities. I don't know. I'm not convinced.
No, either. It's very simple. The dollar is the haven. Physical cash is the haven for illegal activities. Most of the illegal activities carried out around the world are done in dollars and cash. Crypto in general, I think it was less than 1% of all illegal activity was done in crypto. So it's like it's nothing. But it's one of the excuses that the central banks give or the media gives to downplay Bitcoin. But like here's a very simple argument. Like did you know that at the beginning of this year, BlackRock, Fidelity, and all these giant financial firms have started putting their money into Bitcoin now? Like
no.
BlackRock is a giant company. It has $10 trillion under management. So they basically manage people's money. They manage people's pension funds in the United States. That's a lot of money. And they start putting their money into Bitcoin. Now, I'm not saying you should put your money into their ETFs and products. The best way to hold Bitcoin is self-custody. You own your keys. You own your Bitcoin. That's the best way. But if you think you're smarter than Larry Fink and all these financial guys, then I think you should think twice about your opinion in Bitcoin, honestly. Because they've seen something already. I mean, they were late to the game. There's a lot of us nerds and cypherpunks. I got in late to Bitcoin, to be honest, but who got into Bitcoin first? So most Bitcoin is, in theory, held by normal people like you and I.
You know, I want to tell you an anecdote.
Yeah.
I was late. I was not late because I'm always very skeptical. I was aware when Bitcoin got around. And I actively decided not to buy some because I was a student and I had not very much money. And also internet seemed like an accessory to our lives. It wasn't very clear that it was going to be a big thing, even though I was very enthusiastic. But I have a friend here in Merida that is my age, and he bought 5 Bitcoin. At some point in his life, he owned 5 Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And he bought the Bitcoin because he bought some game, and this game came with a gift of 5 Bitcoin, and the game was like $20 or something. And he needed to pay those $20, or I don't remember the details quite well, but he says, I was very nervous to get back my money. And at the end of the year, the Bitcoin was like $5 or something, and I cashed it.
Oof.
And I felt very smart because I had quintupled my investment or whatever. And of course, we were watching the price of Bitcoin at that moment. And
he'd be rich. Well, not rich, but he'd have a lot of money.
Yeah.
For Mexicans, actually, that's a lot of money. You know, like in Mexico, that amount of money can get you pretty far. Like, really good house, good area, good food.
He would have been rich. He would have been rich.
For Mexican standards, it's already like very, very wealthy person. Yeah, those stories are very common in the Bitcoin space. The guy who had like 10 Bitcoin and then just either lost his keys or cashed out when it was like at $50. But there's also another saying in the Bitcoin space that you get Bitcoin at the price you deserve. So, and that's another thing that I've also, a lot of theories that once Bitcoin began to skyrocket and once the older Bitcoiners, like the ones who started hodling in the early years, they will become fantastically wealthy. And then you'll have all these socialists saying that it's not fair, he got lucky, and things like that. And Bitcoiners can foresee a possible future where, like, basic socialist thinking, like, let's take away from them to give to us. Yeah, but they didn't go through the pain that it is to hodl Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's price, especially in the early years, it goes up and down like crazy, and it stays flat and down for a long time, then it goes up. So, like, hodling onto Bitcoin is very, you have to have a strong psychological mind to be able to keep your Bitcoin, not sell. And anyways, I hope this chart kind of helped motivate you to start studying it more, maybe not buying it right away, but to definitely studying and understanding what this is. Stay away from the other shit coins, you know, like Solana and Ethereum. They are centralized. It's basically fiat money. It's like the dollar, it's like the peso, you know. They can inflate the supply away whenever they want. Bitcoin is the only truly decentralized digital asset, and that's what you need. It's digital money. It's an asset. People call it a lot of different things, but Bitcoin is where the real deal is at. And last but not least, people of your thinking, I think we would love someone like you on Noster. You already share a lot of the principles of this ethos. You know, you're an anarchist, you're a carnivore, you have a lot of potential, I would say. And the Spanish community also needs to grow on Noster. There's a lot of English speaking people, obviously. Nothing against that, obviously, but I would like to see the Spanish speaking community to grow more and more and more. And I think your insight would be very valuable, especially from your like philosophical perspective on critical thinking and things like that, you know. So I asked you if you had your phone with you. Could you download the Primal Wallet right now?
I can try. Let me. Hey, maybe I have a problem. I will tell you on camera because we're in. I downloaded a database that supposedly was leaked from the. Suddenly forgot the word, like fiscalías.
Oh, sorry, different phone.
I downloaded a file that was supposed to have information about the links between politicians and crime, organized crime here in Mexico. It was a scam, and I think that my cell phone was hacked.
Oh, really? Oh, that's a shame.
Okay. No, so, and I know what I have to do, but it's a lot of work. So I will try to download the Primal.
We don't have to do it right now, but if you want.
I will. I just okay. won't.
Primal. Primal. It's the most, let's say, simplest and, I guess, user-friendly.
Is it this one?
They call it client. Yeah, that's the one with the swirly purple thing. I got another comment here from Zap.stream. Interesting stream topic, different from your streams with CG. Happy Sunday, Fernando. Thank you very much. I see your NPub, though. I don't see your name. But thank you. Thank you very much for these Satoshis. Yeah, so what you guys are seeing, those who are watching, isn't a probably poor attempt, but an attempt nonetheless to orange pill and purple pill Victor Peralta. Victor, orange pilling.
You're preaching to the choir, you know?
Yeah. It's Ocean B. Ah, hey, Ocean B. Thank you very much for the Satoshis. So, like, Peralta, right now I've been receiving literal money, like Bitcoin, for just streaming. So no banks, no third party. Like, it goes directly to my wallet. That's my Bitcoin right now. And you can decide what to do with it. I'm using it for paying for the streaming service. For some reason, I can't bring it down to 5 sats per minute. It's charging me 10 sats per minute. But oh well, I'll look into that later.
Okay. It's an interesting interface here.
I think you'll love it. I mean, it's still in development. Like, a lot of the apps are clunky. Like, once you make your profile and you get used to using Nostr, download. You have Android or iPhone?
An iPhone.
They say that Damus is a very good client as well. Damus. I have Android. I use Amethyst. But there's different types of clients. Basically, client is like an app that you can use to access Nostr. And Nostr can be used. It's a protocol. Protocol. So you can build all types of things on top of it. Like, you can build a lot of things on top of the internet. But right now, it's mainly used, I guess, for social media type-ish things. Yeah, so Ocean B says that, yeah, Damus, I don't know how to pronounce it, is great on iPhone. I use it. Yeah, it's a very recommended one. But I think Primal is perhaps easier for getting set up. But yeah, there's a lot of problems with Primal sometimes. It's slow. Or things don't show up.
It seems very easy. Very, very easy. Success, it says.
Don't share your NSEC. Okay, it doesn't show anything. It's going to give you something called an NSEC. That's your private, say, key. That's your identity, basically. If someone else gets that, they can be you anywhere in the world. So write that down somewhere on a piece of paper or on a metal plate or whatever. Don't put it on any digital device, you know? Well, there's certain applications where you can put your NSEC to log into things. I'll teach you all about that later. But for now, I think just write it down on a piece of paper or something. But don't worry, it'll be saved in your Primal app as well. You can access that later. So just create an account for now. Worst case scenario, we can create a new account later on. I just want you to see how easy it is to get set up and start receiving Satoshis.
Nostr memes. Yeah, I love memes. So I put that I love memes and I have.
Yeah, it's a very easy, Primal offers a nice and easy intuitive sign up, I guess. Oh, you're already in. Okay, you already have a name?
Yeah, the same.
Okay, so for your first post, just write something. Hello, I'm new here or something, whatever you want. And before posting that, I want you to put the hashtag introductions. And you'll show up on the introductions feed.
I haven't changed my profile picture. I'll do it later.
Yeah, don't worry. I want to show you how easy it is to receive a Bitcoin. Your wallet, there's an integrated wallet inside Primal, so where you can receive Bitcoin already. I don't know if you have it already enabled. I haven't checked out Primal in some time.
So hashtag what?
Introductions. Like write something random, like, hello, I'm new Noster. Whatever you want. And then at the end, put hashtag introductions. And you can say, Dr. Fernando Morales sent me, or something like that.
This orange pill is taking its time.
Let me know when you publish, so I can look.
Already.
You published. All right. I'm going to look for you now. I'm going to, in the search, I'm going for hashtag introductions. Your name, you put your name as Victor Peralta, correct?
Yeah, Del Riego. There are many Victor Peraltas, but Del Riego is very uncommon.
Okay, I'm trying to. There you are. Okay, I found you. Victor Peralta Del Riego. I'm going to send you some Satoshis right now. Okay, you do not have a Lightning address set up to receive sats yet.
Yeah. Don't worry. I'll receive them later. Don't worry. Receive anything you send me. But I need to reset my cell phone, because if I have a wire there, can it be hacked or whatever?
Don't worry. I mean, yeah, you can delete this later on. I just wanted to show you. There's this Lightning icon on the bottom of your Primal app.
Yeah.
Okay. Press that, and you'll be able to enable your Primal wallet. Did you do it?
No. Tell me what it's done. Let me check the what button was it?
One in the middle. No, Lightning one. There you go. Does it tell you something about creating a wallet?
Not yet.
That should be the button.
It's a sort of a circle, a purple circle, like the heartbeat or whatever.
Okay, there's you have to set it up. It should be available from there. So, okay, it looks like my my attempt to orange pill you will be very slow, but at least you got an Ostra account. Wallet connect. Okay, I'll look into that later on then. But you should have one right now.
It seems very interesting. And
I have it right now. Let's see. Pay, purchase now.
They always adapt to whatever the life throws at them.
Who does?
I think anarchists tend to do that.
Huh.
So yeah, if you don't come here and tell me whatever you're telling me, I probably would be lost.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll help you out here later on. Okay, I tried. Sorry, guys. Probably not the best person at purple pilling, but hopefully my orange pilling attempt seed some fruit. Anyways, Victor Peralta, I think we've reached a bit over the hour. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Enjoyed the last part. I definitely enjoyed it, and thank you very much for sharing your perspective on anarchy, carnivore, and politics, Mexican politics, because I am honestly very ignorant about politics. I know more about the United States than Mexico, but mainly because of Bitcoiners, because Bitcoiners are always talking about U.S. politics as well. So anyways,
Before you close, I wanted to say that when I was leftist, I had a very, how do you say, extreme emotional take on all these things. Like, If your politician won an election, you would feel like over the sky or whatever. If your politician lost the election, you would feel like the world is crumbling, very, very negative emotions, and as if your life, your whole life depended on that. And now that I am not a socialist, that has changed. So even though we are in the hands of what I really think is organized crime, in Mexico, they are the same entity, Morena, and I have put it on paper. I have published it in papers and in local newspapers. I have hinted at that, so I have taken some risk at that. I still have hope for our country. So it's going to go through all this, but it's going to be very, very hard. I'm not a theoretician, you know. I'm not just thinking about this from a perspective outside the country. You know, I live this every day, and I really hope Mexicans are as unconquerable as they have been before. I have a friend who says Mexican corruption is a manifestation of your love to freedom. So the tools that people have to get by an excessive authoritarian regime is give a bribe or just twist the last statute or law or whatever.
Yeah, get around things.
Get around things, and I think that if Mexicans are really unconquerable, we'll have a way. We'll have freedom. Will not die, but yeah, of course, you need to prepare for the corruption of everything: the currency, our savings, our social security institutions, everything. So I'm really glad.
I forgot what the saying was, but freedom is not free. Yeah. You have to fight for it. So I do agree that Mexico should at least be divided into three other countries, the North, Central, and South. I have heard a lot of talk about North exit, you know, from Brexit. So where the North splits off from the rest of Mexico, I would totally get behind that. Actually, most of Mexico's economic capacity and production is in the North. A lot of self-sustaining states up here. But yeah, we'll see where this leads. I do see a future in the next, I don't know, it could be 50, 100 years. I do see a future where the world's countries actually do start to break apart. I think the 20th century was full of authoritarianism, expansion of the state. But I think that's going to start reversing now because the problems are showing up. Like you can start seeing all the problems done by the state, especially with fiat, the manipulation of truth. And, you know, the truth, you can't hide the truth. The truth comes out eventually. It's already happening. Like Bitcoiners are pointing out everything, like the money, the food supplies, geoengineering things and stuff like that. Anyways, we can end it here, wrap it up. And again, Victor, thank you for joining us. And hopefully we'll see you on Noster. I think you'll love it here.
I'm going to take a few minutes to go there more. Thank you for inviting me. With such a gentle guidance.
Anytime. Take care.